Star Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you coverage of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Our hosts will review the toys, books, comics, games, and all things related to the Clone Wars animated series. And after each new episode airs on Cartoon Network, our hosts will recap and review the show. And we want to hear your thoughts on The Clone Wars. Call us at 415-508-JEDI every Saturday after a new episode, and your call may be played on the air. Tonight, we listen to your voicemails. Now, let's join Dan to discuss this week's episode, Monster.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Republic Forces Radio Network. We're here tonight to discuss Monster, part two of the Savage Opress trilogy, or Night Sister trilogy as they're calling it, since I guess Savage is only in two parts. Joining me tonight, as always, is a fabulous cast of characters. With me tonight is Jen.
Hello, and I will not choke anybody, I promise.
Jerry.
Hey, guys. But Jen, if you want to prove your loyalty to Republic Forces Radio Network, you must kill Dan.
Oh, great.
Or a random person that you're choosing.
And to guide us through the stormy sea of continuity, Nathan P. Butler.
Hey, everybody. Remember, evil is not born. It is taught. Or you infuse it into somebody with a bunch of magic green light.
Yeah, we're going to get into that because that's kind of strange. Well, once again, we are talking about Monster tonight. Episode 13 of season 3, or episode 2 of season 3.5, depending on how you're keeping score at home. And I hope you are keeping score at home, because we've got a lot of fun things to talk about tonight in this episode. Let's go around the table before we get into specific subjects and see what everyone thought of Monster. We'll start off with Jen.
All right. This was another episode that I really pretty much for the most part enjoyed. There was one thing about it that really bugged me, and we're probably going to get into that later, and that was Savage's backstory basically getting tossed out the window, and he gets like a whole brand new personality via green stuff. I don't even know what it was, but Sierra Mist vapor or something. That really bugged me. But for the most part,
Jen, huh? Jen, Monster energy drink. It's obvious. I never put two and two together. You just said that.
Is that what they were serving on Mandalore?
Don't drink it.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, no, for the most part, though, this was a pretty good episode. I liked it. I thought it developed. I like seeing Asajj Ventress. Anything with her, I really enjoy it. And anything with her, like, kicking all kinds of butt and actually not getting trounced like she usually does, I enjoy. And so I'm having fun seeing her kind of relishing this vengeance and putting it all into motion. I'm having fun with that. And getting to see Savage, like, just womp everybody at the end, that was fun too. But that thing with him, they put all this time into developing him, and then they just, it's gone. That bugged me.
All right, Jerry.
You know, I always felt that this was a really gutsy film, and among part of Charlize Theron's best performances, the fact she got the Academy Award for Monster, just
I think you have the wrong monster.
Oh, crud.
Mike Morin's wrong monster.
Am I embarrassed? Dan, do you recommend? Actually, I really enjoyed the episode, but it did have that feeling halfway through. I'm like, man, what is going on? Why is Savage Opress, like, you know, tiny and getting his butt kicked by Asajj? And he was like the best of the people out there, but still just barely holding on. And I'm just like, man, what's going on? And then it kind of got weird, but then it ended awesome. One thing I will say, I feel like we got a lot more out of this episode than I was expecting, in terms of when the scene ended that they created Savage Opress. I figured that would be it, and that maybe we'd start off next week's episode with the presentation to Count Dooku. I was like, okay, because I wasn't paying attention to the watch or anything. I was like, this episode's still going on. And then they go, you know, Savage goes into that battle. And I was like, wow, this thing's still going on. And so I guess that's a good sign, because I felt like it was, oh, this is cool. So overall, enjoyed the episode, but it certainly wasn't what I was expecting with all the previews that we had seen to this point, which I guess we're now done with everything that's been, you know, shown to us at conventions. And so I'm kind of looking forward to, you know, how they wrap this up.
All right, Nathan B.
You know, this is an episode that I liked. I mean, I enjoyed it. It had really decent fighting sequences. I don't want to say they're great, but very good fighting sequences. very action-packed, but at the same time, it didn't have the wow factor for me that I expected it to have for really a couple of reasons. For the first part, I mean, this was an episode where we had already seen a ton of preview clips, and we were talking before the show about how to kind of look at this by the numbers when it comes to that, so I'll explain what I mean as far as time spent with the previews and whatnot compared to the episode here in a second, but I mean, it seemed like we saw a lot of the episode already, so a lot of the wow factor was gone. It was all stuff, you know, kind of like movie trailers that try to show us a bunch of the best scenes, and then, you know, there's not much left of the movie. And secondly, it seemed like they had basically 10 minutes worth of story to stretch into a 20-minute episode. And I don't know if that, per se, was because there really wasn't that much there, or because they spent so much time on Dathomir. I was expecting something big out of the Battle on Devaron. And the Battle on Devaron lasted just a couple of minutes, and it was basically all that we had seen in the previews. To kind of break this down, since we were talking about the numbers here, so this episode, Monster, by the numbers, the scene on Devaron is a good example here, is a good place to start. The scene on Devaron lasts, if you look at the iTunes file, from about 19 minutes, 30 seconds to 21 minutes, 5 seconds or so, which is not very long, but that's if we're counting the entire sequence. We're talking like the wipe that introduces Savage arriving in space all the way through the wipe after he reports back to Dooku as it switches back to Sereno. Of that stretch, the actual battle is only about from 19 to 2035 in the time code, or a minute long out of a 95-second scene on Devaron. And of that minute of action, we already saw two-thirds of that entire scene from 1952 to 2031, if anybody's counting, aside me out here, that contained everything from Savage leaping down from the ship to the death of the Jedi Master. Really, the only thing we didn't see was him slapping the Padawan around. That's kind of overkill. Now, it doesn't necessarily fit that way for the whole episode, though. The entire episode runs 22 minutes, 35 seconds, again, according to iTunes. The opening newsreel is about 40 seconds. The credits are about 40 seconds at the end. Gives us a total runtime for news story of about 21 minutes, 15 seconds. Of that, we already saw previews of Dooku being asked about Maul, which is about 55 seconds long. The start of the second trial in the dark, 40 seconds. Savage being presented to Dooku, another 40 seconds. And most of the Devaron battle, as I mentioned, another 40 seconds. That's only just shy of 3 minutes out of about 21. Only about a seventh of the episode. So, we'd already seen some, but that left almost 19 minutes of new materials here. The problem was what we did see in the preview scenes were the most impactful scenes. It was like we were given the dots, and the episode was supposed to connect the dots, but the connective tissue was really, really thin. I went through, because I'm a masochist here, and I'm thinking of this in terms of, this is a great episode, but it's also an episode that's really, it's action-packed, but there's not a lot of there other than the action. I mean, this is an episode with no Anakin, no Ahsoka, no Obi-Wan, and for that matter, no Yoda, Mace, Padme, R2-D2, C-3PO, Palpatine, Rex, Cody, Bail Organa, Jar Jar Binks, Grievous, Cad Bane, Aurra Sing, Zero the Hutt, Boba Fett, etc., which is the only episode that can claim that other than Clone Cadets. So I went through there and said, okay, well, what else is it missing? Oh, yes, dialogue. And counted up the number of sentences in the entire episode for each individual character here. Yes, masochist. If we count sentences as correct grammar, so if it's an and after a beginning part, yes, that's a compound sentence, that counts as one, and we count the yes, feral, Savage, no, all of those little one-word things, or when somebody says Count Dooku as a way of introducing themselves, and that counts as a sentence, though they really probably shouldn't, then we had 32 sentences for Dooku, 31 for Talzin, 45 for Asajj, 25 for Savage, 12 for Feral, 6 for Viscus, 1 for the group, yes, sister, 1 for the Jedi Master, 2 for the Padawan, and 1 from a clone. It's about 156 sentences or so, most of which are one or two words, which is the blink of an eye in a 22-minute cartoon. So, I really enjoyed the episode. It was fun, but because we'd seen so much of it, and there wasn't a lot of there outside of the scenes we'd already seen, it kind of left me feeling flat. It was like, wow, that was cool. What's next? And there just wasn't like a what's next that picked it up afterwards. It's one that kind of left me feeling excited at the moment, but flat when it was all said and done.
But, you know, I think that's kind of cool. I mean, I hadn't really noticed while watching the episode necessarily, but when you said it, I was like, oh, well, yeah, they didn't do a lot of talking at all because of all the things going on. And I think it harkens back to how visual Star Wars is. I mean, we've all heard the original New Hope could have been a silent movie. For for all intents and purposes. And I think that's kind of cool because that kind of gets Star Wars, I don't want to say back to its roots, because obviously the themes and the characters in here aren't, you know, original folks. But I thought the episode was really cool in the way it was paced and the way it didn't need all that dialogue to really get us to understand everything going on. It's fascinating, I guess when we think about, you know, K.D. Lucas having written this episode, I guess that wasn't a terribly hard task then, huh?
Well, I guess it depends, because she would have had to, in theory, unless she left it all up to the animator, she would have had to choreograph all the major action sequences. And there's a lot of people from a writing standpoint that I've talked to at conventions and that sort of thing where dialogue is easy. The action sequences, making it all work, making it make sense either to a reader if you're writing prose, or making it make sense to a comic artist, as when I was doing the Tales issue, that was really tough to describe in a way that they could necessarily grasp onto and use exactly. I would imagine it's even harder for doing animation. So she may have even had a tougher task this time than in Night Sisters. I gotta ask, though, on the whole pacing thing, you said you weren't expecting the ending there with Devoron and everything and being presented to Dooku. Doesn't it seem like an inordinate amount of the episode was spent on Dathomir stretching out the selection process, and that we could have at least spent more time on Devoron? Or if nothing else, they shouldn't have shown us as much of Devoron already, so at least there was something really new and exciting to get out of it for the episode?
Well, I didn't really feel like Devoron was important to anything other than just that last glimpse of this episode of how really strong and powerful Savage is. But the events themselves are kind of throwaway. This is just a demonstration to the fans of what just happened to this guy. And you're right, the selection process, I totally did not see that coming. I didn't see that they were going to go select among all the weak. I mean, they're all kind of weak for the most part. I mean, compared to Asajj, I was a little confused. It's like, man, what's going on? Savage is supposed to be awesome. And then I didn't see that coming. So, you know, you're right in the sense that it was a little stretched out, the rounds and the tournament apparently that there were. But I thought once it got started, I thought it was kind of cool to see, really is a good, it was good for to see Asajj go in there and be as powerful as she is. You really don't always get that sense of her. And I guess Savage was the perfect person, because I guess that almost rhymes with Asajj. It's like Asajj would, of course, pick Savage. It should have made sense all along.
I actually kind of enjoy this episode. The pacing was a little bit weird, like Jerry. I thought this one had four ending. This was Return of the King all over again, where I thought we were going to end with him hulking out. Then I thought maybe we were going to end with him being presented, and then thought we'd end with the fight. So it just, wow, it just kept on. Maybe this is the ending. It was only that little timer counter on iTunes that let me know I was wrong. But all in all, a good episode. The trials were a little odd. There was a lot of blatant murder. I feel like we got a more definite answer as to whether this is geared towards the younger kids or the early teens. But all in all, not a horrid episode. It's a good second part of a trilogy. It just makes me a little bit anxious about the third part. Are we going to see the demise of Savage Opress so quickly? Did we get him as we have seen him, this giant, hulked out, badder than bad guy who just takes out an entire army and two Jedi in a minute, just for him to be dead within the next 22-minute episode? Or is this three-parter just going to be an introduction to him, and he's going to show up from time to time over the next half season, season and a half, whatever we have left? So we'll see.
So I guess, Nathan, when this episode's over, are you going to count the minutes of how long I talked?
No. Speaking of, nice. Of Savage and whether or not he's still around after the next episode, I really hope that he does stick around. I mean, this is one of those things. He's like dropping sort of a little miniature nuke into the continuity, not so much because of the effect on him. It's sort of his effect more on Maul than on anything with him. But he's a new character thrown in. He's a new X Factor, kind of like when they brought Ahsoka in, though not nearly to that extent. And I gotta say, I was expecting to kind of be sitting back with Tarjay here. I was gonna get myself confused with Savage Opress, and kind of sit back and, I don't know, I was expecting him to be very one-dimensional. He is just evil, period. He is a tank for the Sith, period. She's the tactical weapon, he's the tank. I actually found, I really enjoyed the way that they handled the character. The facial animations, the way Clancy Brown did the voice role, I felt sympathetic for him. I actually, by the end of it, was almost rooting for Savage against everyone. Like the, I hope that somehow some spark of the personality of what he was comes through, because he was not what I was expecting. I knew that he was going to be killing his brother at some point as his final test. They revealed that in the Clone Wars magazine a while back, for those who actually wound up getting it in the mail finally. But for him to actually be a sympathetic character to start with, and then become what he became, become the monster, it gave him more depth than almost any of the other major baddies in the series. I mean, Grievous never got a moment like that. Asajj really has never gotten a moment like that. Most of the bad guys don't. This time we got a character who was sympathetic, who transforms, and we almost feel bad for him even as we're going to be despising him.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because that's the thing that was really kind of bothering me about this episode, was that they made him so sympathetic, and then they kind of almost wiped the slate with that transformation sequence with him. But it makes him almost all the more tragic. I don't know if you guys watched the Dave Filoni commentary on this episode, and he made a point about saying how Asajj Ventress doesn't realize what she's doing to Savage is almost the same as what Dooku did to her. I don't really know exactly what he's referring to in that, but I thought it was kind of neat to think about, in that she's kind of putting him through horrors, and she went through horrors, and that kind of made her this vengeful, hateful creature that she is. And it was just kind of a neat twist. It still really bothered me that, like, his whole personality gets wiped away, but it also makes him a lot more interesting as a villain compared to a lot of these, unfortunately, more cardboard character ones like Grievous. So I hope he's not gonna die next episode. I'd really like to see him stick around.
Do you think his personality was entirely wiped away? Because there didn't seem to be anything to say for sure either way. I mean, obviously he acted immediately evil following Ventress's orders, like he's essentially brainwashed. In fact, Asajj is the last word of that incantation they use to give him the power, so she probably has some kind of control over him. But you know, like whenever she says, you know, let me go, and his eyes kind of shift in the way they look, I gotta wonder if maybe there's a part of that still in there. I mean, why would they build up that much characterization, A, to kill him off, which I doubt they'll do, but why would they build up that much characterization and then just let it go? I mean, yeah, it gives you that 1-2 punch of, oh man, he was sympathetic, and now I don't know how to feel about the character. But there's gotta be more to it than that, wouldn't you think? I mean, I'd like to think we've seen Katie Lucas enough that we know that she at least thinks a little bit further ahead on her stories than that, right?
I would hope so, but the way they portrayed him in the whole first half of the episode, he was revolving around protecting this sibling, and that's almost all we got to see of him. And so when he kills this sibling, or his relation or friend or whatever, it was kind of like, well, what else is there to him that we know? So I'm hoping we will maybe see something emerge, and maybe he'll maybe have something against Ventress now for having put him through that. But that would be much more interesting, and I'd love to see that, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it almost seems like Savage Opress, and I kind of got this out of Dave Filoni's commentaries too, but it almost seems like Savage Opress is here to kind of help give us the Darth Maul that we never got. So if he gets killed off next week's episode, it's just, I'm going to be really upset. I mean, I wonder if there's ever going to be a point in time, though, when him and, when he and Grievous will have to butt heads somehow, and it's kind of like the ultimate monster tank Sith Lord against Grievous, and is this a challenge, a test for Grievous? I mean, it's kind of funny because you know, this is kind of the same feeling we had of Grievous when we first saw him in the Tartakovsky series. Like, he's just unreal, super powerful, five Jedi, or how many they were, you know, counting the shaggy Jedi, go after him, and they do not stand a chance. You know, a bunch of clones and a Republic gunship show up, and they still can't take him out. It's that same wow factor. Of course, Grievous never quite lived up to that for a variety of reasons, but it almost seems like they're trying to recreate that, along with, hey, people really do like Darth Maul, and yeah, can we do something here? I mean, I don't know if you guys got that from the commentary too, but I kind of read into that a little bit.
Wasn't it Lucas saying, let's bring Maul back? I mean, it was the fans liking the character, but it was Lucas himself who said, let's bring Maul back. And then apparently the Clone Wars team pretty much said, well, you know, he's kind of cut in half. Not that didn't stop him from returning multiple times in the EU, but he's been cut in half, so let's go this other direction. I'll be honest with you, when Lucas says, I want this, and it winds up going a different way, a lot of times it somehow winds up going back around to it. I would not, after hearing that it was Lucas himself who said, let's bring Maul back, and that led to Savage, I would not bet against Maul somehow showing up in the series. If only as flashbacks. with the Savage Opress character perhaps being the one to have the flashbacks or something. I could see Lucas saying, yeah, you know, this is what I wanted, and you kind of went in a similar direction, but I still want what I want. You know what I mean?
So right off the bat, we see the meeting between Mother Deer and Dooku. They're having a nice little sit-down. Now, I have an issue with this, unless it's just the powers at work on Dathomir, just that power. How can Dooku land and basically be around the corner from Ventress and not sense her? How exactly would that possibly work out? Nathan, are we to assume that Dathomir just has that much going on that it would cloud his ability to sense her?
I mean, you can make the argument that Dathomir is so steeped in the Force that that's possible. You can make the argument that she has the ability to sort of to pull her presence in, as we see a lot in the EU. Maybe there's some after effects of the cloaking ability she was given in the previous episode to hide her from Dooku when they went on their assassination mission. These are people who are able to conjure a goblet out of thin air and cause a pike to grow from the ground. I would put nothing past them.
Not only do they summon a goblet out of thin air, they summon it out of an entirely different franchise.
Yeah, you know, Dan, I mean, I thought the same thing. I was like, wow, she was just back there. And, you know, obviously the answer ultimately is it just kind of suited with the story they wanted to tell. But yeah, I guess you could assume with the powers and a lot that we see of Mother Talzin, and then you kind of assume it's like, wow, here's what we're seeing. This is a Sith witch unlike any other, or I don't even know if Sith witch is the right word, but I mean, it's a witch of some variety. I guess we don't even know from this series if these are Force-based or whatnot. I mean, I think we should be led to believe that they are, and correct me if I'm wrong, Nathan, but you kind of, that moment almost kind of made me think, like, wow, what all is she actually capable of doing if she can mess with Dooku's senses a little bit? And it might just be, too, that Dooku's so convinced she's dead, he might not even be thinking to look for her presence or recognize, I don't know. I mean, but I just figured, hey, that's what the story needs to have, just a quick, simple, Asajj jumps out, they talk a little bit just to help kind of fill the audience in.
God only knows what was in that cup. She could have slipped anything in there, down in his senses or something, who knows.
Dooku is promised a Night Brother, as we find out that they're called, and Mother and Asajj have a plan to make sure that this apprentice is under Asajj's control so that she can steer him in her goals, not necessarily to what Dooku wants. So Asajj jumps on her Dathomir speeder, which we already know we're going to get a toy of, in Lego form at least, and goes off to the other side of the planet to the Night Brothers camp. That's got to be awkward for the dating scene, I just got to say. And we are introduced to the Zabrak men, who are the Night Brothers, in a variety of oranges, yellows, and red patterns. So everybody's happy, I would assume. Hopefully everybody's happy in Savage being orange or yellow and Maul being red. We're okay with that. And the selection process begins, and we see the games, which are just odd. What did you guys think of those games? A little different. She selected six and slowly killed them, and didn't seem like anybody was really standing up to her. So I'm not really sure how the selection process was working.
Well, I thought it was funny at first when she was just walking around the first group and, you know, too weak, too soft, too this. And, you know, it's just, it felt very much like a drill sergeant, like you're in the army now, soldier. And to me, the thing felt kind of weird because, okay, let me get this straight. We train Night Brothers and we train to be warriors. And the selection process is that we're going to give you six of our best, or are they? And you're going to kill five of them. Really? I mean, maybe the other five just need more training and they'll be okay for you in, you know, in a couple seasons. I mean, that seemed weird. That seemed weird to me.
Maybe kind of wonder how much power the Night Sisters have over the Night Brothers. I mean, if they are really willing to give up their best as basically fodder to weed out who is the best of the best, and then, you know, their top soldiers or top warriors are gone, you know, what type of pressure must be exerted by the Night Sisters, or control must be exerted by them over the Zabraks here to be able to get them to be willing to do such a thing? And I will say that scene, you know, the too weak, too small, too this, too that, the Goldilocks type scene there with the drill sergeant of Asajj going through the group, I, again, was impressed by her level of power, because she slaps one of them straight up upside his ear. And Zabraks have horns right there. And she comes off without a scratch.
The fact that she was killing them struck me as very odd. I guess the only thing I can think of is they were doing it to try and deliberately show how evil she is and how ruthless she is and how determined she is to get this done. But other than that, it struck me as kind of a waste. And I don't see, even if they regard males on this planet as like chattel, I would think they would want to at least maintain the breeding stock, if nothing else. So it just struck me as really odd that they were just, okay, no, he's no good. Get rid of him. Nope, he's no good. Kill him too. It was just weird.
Right. So we're introduced to the trials, three different trials. The first where everyone attacks Asajj. The second where Asajj attacks everyone in the dark. And then the third where we jump around on moving blocks. To what end? I'm not sure. That one was rather confusing. Which made me wonder, was the third trial actually when, after he had been transformed, when Savaj was ordered to kill his brother? Because Asajj referred to that as the final test. And I wonder, was that the test of, is the transformation complete? Or was that actually the third trial?
Well, I guess I'm not following the count there a little bit. I mean, there are the three trials for sure that we saw on the planet to select the one. And yeah, I kind of jokingly said, I watched it with my wife, and I said, oh, this must be the Super Mario trial because of all the changing platforms. And there's an 8-bit retro game in these trials somewhere with all the platforms and things jumping. And then she commented, that's like, well, it's kind of like that show on ABC called Wipeout, you know, where all the platforms just jump and you got to climb through everything and fall into the water every so often. So we kind of had some fun with that one. It seemed a little silly. But I think the last trial, if you want to call that, where he killed the brother, I'm assuming that just to recognize they have full control of the mind, that whoever was would have been selected would have had to have gone through a similar thing, you know, whoever that person may have been. So is that a fourth trial or just, you know, we selected our person, but we need to make sure this person's completely under our control and has no sympathy for anything? Because Savaj clearly had a really good side of him. I mean, he's worried about his brother. He wanted to, you know, take care of him. He kind of turned his back on Asajj, which wasn't very smart because he was concerned with his brother. And at first I thought, wow, this Savaj guy's a pretty decent guy, I guess, for a Knight brother. And, you know, how is he going to be this kind of warrior for Asajj for Dooku? And, well, I guess we got the answer, but that's how I took it, is that was just the final test to make sure that what they did to him actually took.
The idea of that final test, the you must kill your brother test, I mean, if you take that back, I mean, that's basically, that was very similar to Dooku's final test before he became a Sith. Within EU parlance, and I think, I'm not 100% sure on this, if you take the background for Dooku and you go back to some of the stuff that Lucas said about where he wanted the character to come from, I think it's actually a Lucas idea that Dooku's final challenge was to kill Sifo Dyas. I'll mention it in Continuity Corner, but the idea of a Sith or someone dark side having to kill someone close to them as a final test is something that does at least have some precedent. I'm not sure it's necessarily part of the weeding out process to pick him. It's more like, is he, you are now chosen, are you worthy? Whether the other ones are, who is worthy to be chosen? You know what I mean?
Okay.
If you think about it too, this is stretching it a little bit, but Anakin kills Mace Windu right before he turns to the dark side. And while that's not someone who's necessarily close to him, it was somebody he was kind of in a position of like respect and authority over him. So maybe that's kind of a traditional Sith technique. I don't know.
All right. Very good. And of course, all that takes place after the transformation, which we kind of touched on before, takes place with the green gobbledygook stuff and a little bit of chanting. So here we are seeing the Night Sisters dabbling in alchemy and magic, which I think based on some of the titles that we're seeing in later episodes, I think this is going to be not necessarily a theme, but a tool that they're going to use in future storytelling. Hopefully not to the extent that we saw, say, in Ewoks Season 2, but I think they're going to be more willing to use that as a storytelling element.
I find it interesting that very recently Leland Chi, I think it was on his Twitter, posted that there is a holocron entry all specifically about different forms of magic. Not force use, but magic, which I'm assuming ties into stuff with this. Otherwise, why would he have mentioned it right around the time Night Sisters was coming out?
So we do have confirmation from Leland that it is magic. So that begs the question, how do you guys feel about that? Always before, the mystical power in the universe has been the Force. We've had previous EU with Night Sisters and Sith Witches and things like that, where their what they thought was magic was more of use of the Force. In the old Sith, they did some alchemy and things, but it was also incorporating the Force. This is turning into more blatant magic. Does that have a place in our Star Wars?
My initial thought to it, and actually where my mind was really going with the question when you first started, was not how do I feel about it from an expanded universe perspective, but how do I feel about it being on this show? The, you know, like my real life, you know, nonfiction reaction to it. And maybe I'll go there for a second. But you know, we talked about the violence and what's the audience and the kids. I actually thought the violence was watered down enough visually. If some things were done off screen, implied. I was actually more nervous when all the whole magic thing started and they're doing these ceremonies. We saw it last week too, and that's when I actually looked over at my son and said, "Hey, is he paying attention to the scene?" Because I got a little uncomfortable with that, to be honest with you, for a variety of reasons. I wish the show wouldn't be giving us the ceremonies and the incantations and kind of seeing the magic and the cult-like aspects of it. That's actually what I'm a little bit more concerned about as a parent, more so than some of the violence we saw. I thought that was okay. I mean, granted, violence is never, you know, something that you're like, oh yeah, great, give me more violence. But I mean, it's just to me, I didn't think that was that bad. Now, to answer your other question, basically, that's where I got a little tripped up earlier about where does it fit in? What, were they doing magic? Was it the Force? I was a little confused. I wasn't sure if she's Force sensitive or just knows what she knows in the world of magic. And I guess to me, it seems like it's already established, but I personally wish Star Wars would just leave the mysticism to the Force.
Well, first off, Jerry, don't worry. Don't worry when it comes to Talzin. She's not a witch. She's nothing you've heard. No. The whole thing of magic, though, when I say that Leland has mentioned having a separate category for magic or a separate type of holocron list, I'm not saying that it's not Force-based. It's that there are some forms of Force use that are so arcane, the way it's described in various source books and that sort of thing, that it's viewed as essentially magic. It's not so much that it's, you know, it is meant to be magic. I mean, even the most magical stuff that we see with Charl in Ewoks: The Battle for Endor, she has been retconned to being a Night Sister using Night Sister style, quote unquote, magic, dark side based magic. So it seems like pretty much anything mystical in Star Wars, a lot of times they'll dabble it back into it. Most sources, when they do try to touch on the term of magic, either use it as a way of referring to arcane force stuff, or they consider it a slightly separate idea, but make it very vague, like, well, philosophers aren't sure, or the Jedi have studied but have come to no conclusions on, to try to make it sort of still seem like it fits within that. So I guess to answer Dan's question, I mean, as long as, I would say, at least as far as the way that George Lucas approaches the storytelling of Star Wars and the use of the Force and how that's been expanded upon, as long as it's not something said to be different than the Force, definitely something that is completely separate from it or that somehow invalidates it, even if it is separate, I'm not sure that there's any way we could say that it's not something that belongs in Star Wars. I mean, Star Wars has had interstellar invasions. Star Wars has recently had the introduction of the term, fail. Like epic fail, except fail in Red Harvest. We've got noob and newbie making its way in. I mean, if some of the weirder aspects and the more pop cultural aspects of our lives can make their way into it, I'm not sure that something that is at least a fantasy trope like magic is necessarily a bad thing to have within Star Wars. It needs to be tempered a bit, but I mean, belongs like just about anything else. An anti-force being like Waru, for example, and zombies.
I took it as more like almost the stage magic type of definition of magic in terms of like trickery and fooling the eye and a lot of like illusion and misleading people type of magic as opposed to wizards and Gandalf and stuff like that. I just thought it was just different usage of the Force, and that's kind of how I'm going to continue to interpret it unless someone says flat out, no, this is something totally different, because otherwise it doesn't really seem like it would fit with the Star Wars that we've been knowing for so long. It seems like it would just be injected in there really at random, and we would never have really encountered anything like that before anywhere in Star Wars, and it would kind of jolt it out of that sci-fi category into something really different. So I think it's just different definition of Force usage.
At least the Night Sisters have a precedent, though. I mean, the Night Sisters have existed for a long time in the Star Wars Expanded Universe, and they dabbled in it a little bit for Clone Wars with the Jedi Alliance video game. I mean, at least it's something that has precedent. It's not something that's totally being sprung on us out of nowhere. It's not like, from here forth, you'll be known as Darth Copperfield or something like that. You know, I mean, it's very much, it's something we've seen before. It's just being taken into Lucas's playground now as opposed to Lucasfilm's playground.
Did anybody else have any thoughts on just the how appropriate the visuals, though, are for a quote-unquote children's show? Or am I just kind of being the prude here?
Well, you know what the most banned books? I think this is what the study showed earlier this year. I saw on one of those end-of-the-year recap shows for 2010, one of the most banned books or the most banned book in any school across the world, not just the United States, I think, was Harry Potter because of the whole witchcraft and wizardry stuff. Is it inappropriate? It depends on your perspective. If you believe that anything like that shows too much of the occult, then yeah, obviously it'd be considered inappropriate. What I'm more thinking of when it comes to imagery, though, is the violence in the episode. Yeah, it was tempered, but we see a guy skewered through his stomach or his chest and slung backward by that spear that he tossed that winds up being tossed right back to him, or pike or whatever it was. And here, this is the same Cartoon Network that censored Asajj Ventress kissing a clone before killing him. There's really a weird, it's almost like the MPAA are the ones doing the censoring as opposed to being Cartoon Network saying, hey, let's do this, let's do that, and using the television code, which I don't think is MPAA driven. I would be much more concerned about the violence in the episode with young children than the incantations. There's so many more cartoons that play around with that sort of thing. Maybe they don't take it quite as seriously, but in a world of Harry Potter, this would not bother me as a parent.
The incantations and stuff didn't really bother me, but I think, and even if I was a parent, I don't think it would have bothered me, just because it was kind of portrayed in a negative light. I know a lot of the concern about Harry Potter was that it was making magic and the occult positive, and the hero was the magician. So I don't know, I guess for people who are concerned about that, it didn't bother me really, but for people who are concerned about that, I think maybe it's tempered a little bit by the fact that it's the bad guys who are doing it, and so it's got a negative aspect, and you know, kids don't want to emulate the bad guys, they want to emulate the good guys. I was much more concerned with the violence as well. I was just too busy cringing from all of the sounds of popping, you know, cartilage in people's throats the entire episode.
I just like that my favorite piece of violence has to be the Padawan. I mean, you get this great quick martial arts moves by his aged sounding master, whoa, 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 and then the master's kill, and here comes the Padawan jumping in. You don't even get to see him fight, it's just splat up against the wall. That was a moment of beauty for me.
Oh, the action in the show was pretty good for certain.
There was definitely a lot of action. Okay, so through mystic arts of one form or another, Savage Opress is transformed from a
mild-mannered
six-foot-tall semi-weakling with a few hand-to-hand combat skills to this massive 7-foot Hulk who can barely form a sentence and snaps his brother's neck. Was it just me, or was he dumbed down a little bit by the monster juice?
Savage smash!
Exactly. It wasn't until his very last line where he managed to actually put together a full sentence, and even that was 4 words. So
yeah.
But there was something in his eye when he did kneel before Dooku, where there's a glimmer of something still in there. Dooku is presented with his new assassin, Savage Opress. And he seems very impressed, but he has a little test for his new henchman. He's going to send him off to put the smackdown on some Republic troops and a couple Jedi, as we've touched on. And here we see one of the clips that, as Nathan pointed out, we've seen over and over since Celebration, when they first dropped this nuke on us that Savage Opress was coming. How did it play out to you, seeing it as context of a show rather than just a snippet? Did you feel like it was a fulfilling sequence? Was it something that maybe they should have kept for next week's episode?
Well, I mean, since we've seen it over and over again, I'm glad it was part of this week's episode and not taking away from time next week that could be the new stuff. But to your point, once I saw the ship land, it's like, oh, okay, here's that scene. Yep, yep, coming out. Yep, put Spike in the ground, make the big crack. Everybody's impressed or oppressed. And okay, let's move on. It didn't have any wow because we've seen it, but that's okay. That scene really couldn't have had any wow because the real wow scene was him coming off the table and crushing his brother's neck. This was just the here he is, but we've already seen him. So that scene could just went on. I'm glad it didn't like take up 2 minutes or whatever it was from next week's episode. I'm glad it's out of the way.
Yeah. Thrilling scene. Great introduction to the character's power. It's just that we'd seen it before. It lacked the wow that it could have had we not seen it before. I will say, though, as far as the way that scene was directed, it was really directed very well. The action of it is done well. You really get that sense of this is just this immovable object that is bearing down on you, or I guess immovable as in you can't move it because it's certainly moving itself. This object that's just bearing down relentlessly that will not stop. Because they do a really good job of not focusing on the clones except for that one that says, you know, get him! And even then, it's kind of an off-kilter camera angle, or whatever you want to call it. And then we wind up with this just slapping him left and right. As long as he keeps up that type of power, it really works. And I think that's why I'm so happy that they got Clancy Brown to do this voice, because it's a perfect growly, grumbly voice for this character. I mean, they got the Kurgan from Highlander to play Savage Opress. It's this great presence that he has. And as long as they don't undermine that character somehow and leave him this quasi-complex, hopefully not just Hulk smash type of character, it made for a great introduction. I just wish we hadn't seen all of it before. Give us snippets in a preview, but don't give us... It felt like they were just trying to feed us bits and pieces to build up the hype. It felt like The Phantom Menace all over again. It felt like, here's a little bit, how do you like that? Here's a little bit, how do you like that? All right, you ready for the big thing? Oh, we showed you all the cool stuff so far. You know what I mean?
So Savage passes his test with flying colors, and he's back with his new quote-unquote master being praised. And Dooku tells him that he could rival the powers of the late Darth Maul, and together they could topple Darth Sidious. Now, is this a plan that he's had all along? Because this wasn't really a conversation, at least as far as I know, that we've ever been privy to. That's never a conversation he had with Asajj. But now that he's got this new guy, and he had to get this new guy because Palpatine or Sidious made him get rid of Ventress, is it in his head now that, hey, he's just going to make me get rid of somebody if I get them more power, if I get somebody powerful again? Let's get this game going so that we can topple him quickly. That kind of struck me as, I don't know, maybe a new idea in Dooku's mind. Maybe he wasn't thinking about it immediately before, but now he kind of is.
I took it as kind of a typical Sith seduction, kind of like luring him in with more power, and you've got a taste of victory, and I'll give you more of that if you just stick with me, and like we'll rule everything. And it's kind of the same spiel that Sidious gave Anakin, and I'm assuming probably the same spiel that Sidious gave Dooku before. And I know that my memory of the Tartakovsky series is kind of vague, but I know he was kind of luring Asajj with that promise of power too. So I took it as just kind of his par for the course beginning speech to break in a new apprentice.
Yeah, I think the thing about Dooku that really stood out wasn't so much his offer of power there, so much as the loss it seemed like he actually felt about Ventress. I mean, this is a guy who, granted, I mean, he tempts with power and that sort of thing. Maybe this time he feels like he has an apprentice, or whatever you want to call Savage, he has an apprentice who might have a chance of with him actually being able to topple Sidious. Because, of course, you know, he's been disappointed in Grievous before. He's been disappointed in Ventress plenty before. And he's kind of got these flunkies who, as we keep pointing out here on the show, keep getting their butts kicked all the time. And now he's got somebody who, thus far, in one battle against one Jedi and his little teeny tiny splattering Padawan, has not faced defeat yet. And I loved it. The fact that he actually flat out says that, instead of it just being hinted, I had shades of, you know, Luke and Vader, shades of the Emperor tempting Vader in the Dark Empire audio drama, Starkiller even, just a lot of this, wow, we're really kind of amping up that energy. But I gotta wonder if there's perhaps part of it that does go back, as far as like his maybe wanting to topple Sidious sooner rather than later, might perhaps go back, at least in part, to Ventress going. As I said, it played very well of him feeling like there was a loss when Ventress was gone. I mean, you could almost hear the sadness in his voice in the previous episode where he says, "You have failed me for the last time," and finally orders her death. It seemed like he was hurt by that. He initially resists the idea, and maybe that's a tipping point for the character. Now, how much they would play off that tipping point in future episodes, we don't know. Sometimes they play off stuff, sometimes they completely ignore it. But I think there's a lot more complexity to Dooku in the little bit of presentation that he has in these episodes. He's still the same guy that he was before, but there's that extra layer there when it comes to these apprentices. It's nice to see that he's not just made of stone, like the way his head looks. No, am I seeing things, though? I mean, was I the only person who saw sort of that hurt with Dooku? I mean, maybe I was just imagining it, but it sure seemed to me that Corey Burton was really playing into that hurt voice, and the facial expression seemed to convey that. Maybe I'm just reading too much into what I thought I saw.
No, I agree with you there. I do think that Dooku, he didn't want to put down, he did not want to put Ventress down. He was forced to do it by Sidious, and that's why I think this may have spurned some of that speech to oppress at the end, is he doesn't want to have another apprentice that he has to eliminate because his master gets wise to what's going on. He doesn't want that to happen. And maybe it's a little bit of vengeance for having to kill Ventress, which he thinks that he did. So yeah, I thought that was some very good voice acting on behalf of Corey. So now we've learned that Darth Maul is kin to Savage Opress and the Knight Brothers. What else did we learn from this week's episode, or unlearn, as the case might be? Nathan, take us down to Continuity Corner.
Well, the biggest revelations here, continuity-wise, have to do with the background not of Savage Opress, but of Darth Maul, hinted at throughout the episode, and his relationship to Dathomir. We learned that Darth Maul was a Zabrak pretty early on, as was Eeth Koth, a Jedi Council member who also premiered in The Phantom Menace. As the EU very quickly tried to flesh out the Zabraks, we were given their homeworld, Iridonia, and it was assumed that Maul hailed from there. In fact, the Darth Maul Journal by Jude Watson specifically mentions this background, explaining that he was taken from Iridonia as a child by Darth Sidious, while Sidious was still the Sith apprentice to Darth Plagueis, according to the New Essential Chronology, and he was forged into a new Sith apprentice for Sidious when he eventually took down Plagueis. We were told that Maul's tattoos were Sith tattoos, specifically applied to his body by Sidious himself, and he forged his double-bladed lightsaber based on Exar Kun's from the Tales of the Jedi comics after being defeated by a Jedi who wielded a staff in combat. His final test, at the time, was said to be a month dumped on an isolated planet, forced to fend for himself. Maul attacks Sidious when he finally returned for his Sith in training, and the very act of wanting to destroy his master proved that he was ready to be a Sith alongside Sidious. We then saw most of his earliest missions in Phantom Menace-era tie-in materials, such as the novel Darth Maul Shadowhunter, the ebook Darth Maul Saboteur, Episode 1 Adventures like The Fury of Darth Maul, and that's Episode 1 Adventures, the scholastic quasi-RPG for kids, not the Episode 1 tie-in comic book one-shots that went under the name Episode 1 Adventures in trade paperback form. Different thing entirely. And you had, of course, the Darth Maul comic book series that was so iconic in its era. We had also learned a bit previously about Dathomir, which first appeared in Dave Wolverton's Courtship of Princess Leia. Over the years, the backstory of Dathomir developed to include stints under the rule of the Rakatans, from Knights of the Old Republic, the game, not the comic series, the Brotherhood of Darkness of the new Sith Wars era, and others. More recent history, though, shaped the Dathomir that we're most familiar with, one where a male-dominated society was transformed by the arrival of a banished Jedi, Aaliyah, no, not the dead musician, who helped craft a female-dominated society. Some male-led clans remained, but they were presumed to be few and far between, until after contact with the New Republic, specifically Luke Skywalker, helped to transform its society once again with the marriage of Tenennial Joe and Prince Isolder of the Hapens. Most importantly, though, we were introduced to the idea that many of these Dathomiri women had force abilities, passed down as a form of witchcraft over the centuries. And these witches of Dathomir, as they were called, had their dark side counterparts, the Night Sisters, who were in conflict with the witches but seemed lesser in number in most eras. Now, just like last week when we saw the previously existing backstory of Asajj Ventress tweaked so that she was from Dathomir and taken by slavers, then found by Kyneric on Ratatak, rather than being the child of slain parents on Ratatak found by the same Jedi, we have an instance of the expanded universe being melded with new continuity from the Clone Wars T-canon to create a sort of hybrid backstory. Little of Maul's actual training and missions under Sidious seem to have been tweaked. However, it is suggested that he was an adult warrior by the time that he was handed over to Sidious, rather than a child as in his previous EU backstory. and his tattoos could no longer have been applied by Sidious himself. Moreover, his origins certainly have been tweaked substantially. That is, where he actually came from, not his training. Rather than being from the Zabrak homeworld of Iridonia, we are now told that Zabraks were active in spreading many colonies, and Dathomir has its own colony of male Zabraks. This actually kind of sits well with the idea of the original backstories of Dathomir, given that these independent male Zabraks are a colony on the planet, not native males, who would have been enslaved by the witches over the centuries after Aaliyah's coming. Maul is now said to be from this colony of Zabraks, as a brother, if not literally, then at least as kin, of Savage Opress and Feral. We also discover here that the tattoos worn by Maul are not, as Leland Chi confirmed to me via email quite a while ago, Sith tattoos. Instead, they are tattoos from this particular group of Dathomiri Zabrak warriors. That certainly puts a new spin on these tattoos being used by the Sith of Darth Krayt's One Sith in the Legacy comic era. Though one could very easily argue that the first known Sith of the prequel era from the Jedi's perspective, Darth Maul, was likely the first Sith that Asherad Het, aka the future Darth Krayt, had ever investigated, and thus his image left an indelible impression of supposedly Sith tattoos on that future Sith Emperor. Maul's influence is also, of course, felt with his fellow clansmen here. The shirtless Zabraks with their tattoos were directly inspired by art by Ian McKaig, which was designed in order to let the Darth Maul comic book show him without his robes for the first time. We also have a nice echo of continuity here in the idea that a final test of loyalty would be killing one's own brother, or someone at least very close to them. We saw this in the EU with Dooku, whose final test before becoming the Sith apprentice to Darth Sidious was to kill Sifo Dyas, the Jedi Master who had ordered the clones on Kamino. There's plenty more about that if you want to check it out in the EU. We also have some potential future story hooks here, because nothing has been explained in continuity thus far about, say, Talzin's debt to Dooku, which the official site's episode guide suggests may have been from when Dooku was still a Jedi, thus sometime prior to Qui-Gon Jinn's death in The Phantom Menace. There's also kind of a neat reference to Willow here, that is, the movie Willow, specifically Blackroot, which in that film Mad Mardigan, Val Kilmer, tried to feed to baby Allura Dannon, much to the anger of Willow, played by Warwick Davis. We also learn a few more nifty little items from the StarWars.com episode guide for Monster, such as the fact that Savage's armor is based on Roman armor, and his blade, which they call a spear for some reason, has a tip that can be fired. We learn that the clan is known as the, I kid you not, Knight Brothers, and their leader was Viscus, that is V-I-S-C-U-S, like the singular of internal organ viscera, not viscous like sticky and adhesive. Though, you know, kind of sucks to be named either one. We also learned that the Jedi and Padawan killed by Savage on Deveron, which is another EU planet, were Halsey and Nox, respectively. However, Halsey actually first appeared not here, but in the background of Grievous Intrigue, though he was unnamed and identified at various times as Jafo Ong, Tucker Valu, and Lev Loa before being given his final name, which is a lot easier to pronounce. He's also not a new character model per se, because his body is that of Kit Fisto, just with new textures, and the Padawan, Nox, has a body that's basically that of Bola Ropal from Cargo of Doom, which, incidentally, also featured the Deveron system. Beyond that, let me close out this continuity corner by noting that the voice actor for Savage Opress, Clancy Brown, whom I know best as Kurgan from Highlander or John Danziger from Earth 2, might be best known to Star Wars fans as the voice of Montross in the Bounty Hunter video game for previous gen gaming systems that told the backstory of Count Dooku sending Jango Fett after Asajj Ventress's predecessor in the crazy female two-lightsaber-wielding Sith apprentice wacko nutjob ladies department, Kamari Vosa.
Thank you, Nathan. Now we did get actually several voicemails this week.
Hi, this is Luke. I'd just like to say I like what you do. I especially like when you do the Survival Pet special force thingy. And I also like when you do the holiday special. I like how everyone has a different view of the episode because it just does so great. And bye.
Hi, everyone. It's Robert Darth Akari calling in for Republic Forces Radio Network. Just getting my thoughts on Monster. Very impressive. I'm kind of sort of taken aback in a way with the whole level of violence that they're starting to accept as part of Clone Wars. I mean, not that it's a bad thing, but it's just like, I really did not expect the whole strangulation scene to go the way that it did. But that was pretty hardcore. The Ninth Sister's force use, mysticism, magic, technology, whatever you want to call it, it's a little, I think it's going to take a little bit of getting used to. I mean, it, at points in time, it seems a little too fantastical for the Star Wars universe, which always seemed to be at least somewhat rooted in reality. I mean, the whole materializing the staff thing and the sort of hulking up effect. But I guess there's some way of explaining it. I'm looking forward to hearing that if you cover it in today in the podcast and all. But you definitely tell the production values have gone up, you know, by leaps and bounds over the previous seasons. And the choreography and the fight sequences are beautiful. One thing I do want to mention on the collecting front, I really want them to make that little Night Sister speeder car. That thing was pretty darn cool. Be great if they could figure out a way to make it glow red in the back, but then we'll see what happens. It only appears in this one little arc, and odds are we won't get it, but I'm still kind of rooting for it. But otherwise, always enjoying the show. I'll call you in with my thoughts on the finale of the Night Sisters arc, and talk to you later. Bye.
You know, that Night Sisters vehicle, that speeder, gets great gas mileage. You can go entirely across the planet with it, apparently. Didn't you say, though, that they were making a toy out of this, or at least making a Lego out of this earlier?
Yes, that is actually one of the confirmed sets for summer to fall of 2011, is the Night Sister speeder. There aren't any pictures of it yet, but I'm sure it'll probably come with an Asajj and probably a Savage, too. Maybe even a Mother Talzin Lego.
This is Glenn calling in with my thoughts on the Clone Wars episode Monster. To me, something was off in the very beginning from the opening newsreel, which really would have worked so much better if it had been sort of a previously on Clone Wars like they did with the previous series. I mean, who's the audience for this newsreel? It's not the Republic. It's not the Separatists. It's just like the Night Sisters, because, you know, the Separatists know, and Dooku would know. And, you know, I don't know if there was something different in the sound effect there, but last week I sort of liked how Mother Talzin spoke and Night Sisters, but this week it really wore on me. Then we go with the men's encampment is, you know, really far away, maybe too far for Ventress to be riding a Rancor, but I was really disappointed that we didn't see one at all, you know, roaming the countryside, or it would have been a useful thing to have on one of these trials, but I really wanted to see a Rancor. I really don't see if the males were they really motivated. Did they want to be chosen? Did they not want to be chosen? I couldn't really tell. They seemed like they were really doing okay on their own in the village, and they're just sort of a little bit afraid in general of the Night Sisters, but it was kind of weird there. And as for the trials, I mean, I liked the first two, but the third one, I didn't quite understand what the point was with the ground moving up and down. If, you know, it didn't seem like falling off the pillars hurt them that much or anything, and you know, it just baffled me what exactly the point was there. And then once they get back and he's chosen, Mother describes him as being the perfect male specimen and having all the tape. So then why do they have to transform him? I mean, I would have really liked her to have said, you know, he will be perfect for the transformation or something like that, because, you know, then you get like a frightened reaction from Savage, and then she knocks him out. And then when he wakes up, you sort of really understand that, you know, what they've done there. And instead, it's like, you know, I thought they were going to teach him hate, and instead it's sort of as if they've infused this hate and this power in him with magic. And I think if Ventress had sort of given her speech, don't sympathize with the enemy, and then sort of presented Pharrell as being his enemy, that would have been a much more powerful and stronger scene. I mean, as it was, it seems like, what? He just saved him a second ago, and now he's killing him, you know, without any thought about it at all. I would have liked to see a little bit of thought take place, either from the speech or something before that. Even with all my complaints that I've made here, sort of, I think there are a lot of good things about this episode. I mean, the scene on Devrin was really impressive. He was, you know, taking people out right and left. It was a little quick, maybe, but that didn't bother me. But the sound on that scene was really impressive, you know, making clear what happened even when it was off screen. That was really good. The animation throughout the episode was just outstanding. The thing that stuck out for me was the scene of the character's breath during the sort of the second trial on Dathomir. But then back, you know, the final scene to me was a little bit puzzling as well. They seem to be contradicting the EU as regards Dooku's motivations here. And it's even more true this week because we see him being ambitious and wanting to take over the galaxy, where I think the EU sort of had him being much more not ambitious and not subservient. That's why he was sort of chosen to be the apprentice, that he was sort of a Sith army or something like that. And I look forward to hearing Nathan's take on that specific issue and the whole crew's take on this, what to me was a rather disappointing episode.
I think I'm right there with Glenn on the whole issue of the Rancors. I mean, that is something that has been iconic for Dathomir pretty much since day one. And we didn't get to see any of it. Now, granted, we also didn't get to see any of the regular witches of Dathomir, any of the good Force users on the planet. We didn't get to see the Chunthor remains or anything like that. But for something that is supposed to be so indigenous there, so much so that they've spent a lot of time building up backstory for the Rancors, that is sort of odd that it's not there, especially if Katie Lucas is digging into the EU to build up this environment and these characters that she's giving us in these three episodes. As for the audience for the newsreel, I mean, I'm kind of torn either way, because at the same time that we can say, well, they're meant for people who are in the universe to read them, or to hear them, first off, they're revealing information sometimes that obviously the natural people of the galaxy aren't going to know. Like, and behind the scenes, Darth Sidious is, wait, who's Darth Sidious again? They've identified the second Sith, because he was in a newsreel somewhere. At the same time, though, it is supposed to at least feel like it's an in-universe sort of thing. Like, if you go back to the earliest chronological episode, Cat and Mouse, what did they do? They treated it like a previously on. They gave all these background scenes, and for the most part, they were scenes that were derived from the experiences they were going to go through in that episode, but it was stuff that was new, or at least made to look new in a couple of cases to make it feel as though there had been some storyline before that, and now we were picking up with that episode. But that's sort of the exception rather than the rule. A lot of times we get newsreels where, yeah, what they're saying fits that particular episode, but the footage is all over the place, including from episodes that chronologically wouldn't have happened yet, assuming that the order of episodes as we know it right now will stand. Leland Chee and even Dave Filoni and others have said, don't try to place episodes based on what you see in the newsreel, what clips you see used in the newsreel, because it's whatever they have at the time. So I don't know. I think there's a valid point to be said of why not just make it a previously on, but at the same time, I'm not sure we can necessarily say it's the audience in the galaxy either, not necessarily. As to the issue of him being the perfect man, hey, every woman wants to change a man, even the perfect one. I mean, ask our married guys here. Am I right, fellas? As for why was Dooku chosen to be the apprentice? Because there was already a master. You get to be a Sith master by being the Sith apprentice and taking down the previous master, assuming that there is one, unless you're someone like a Jason Solo becoming a Sith Lord by kind of circumventing a teacher that's not technically a Sith Lord, though she called herself one, all that kind of stuff with Lumaya. It's kind of a natural progression of apprentice becomes the master, takes another apprentice, or takes an apprentice beforehand and usurps the master together. It's that kind of natural cycle. I don't see where it was necessarily a lack of ambition on Dooku's part. He obviously wanted the power in one form or another. He was willing to become the Sith apprentice to Darth Sidious. He doesn't immediately try to usurp Sidious and really never gets a chance to, because he's only the apprentice for a fairly short time. You got the 10 years where they're building up the Separatists post-Phantom Menace leading up to Attack of the Clones. Then they're engaged in the Clone Wars, where one of them's leading either side trying to build up this conflict here. And before the Clone Wars are able to officially end, goodbye Dooku's cranium, you know? So I don't know if it's a lack of ambition. The EU didn't really push much in the way of an ambition for him, but on the other hand, they didn't also weaken him either by saying that he's some kind of pansy who's totally always there to be the second fiddle. He certainly was building up his own dark side acolytes like Sora Bulk in the background and that sort of thing, and grooming Quinlan Vos as Corto Vos over time. But I don't know. I think there's some definite good points in there. It's just a question of I guess, how much we're willing to give credit to the creative team in terms of what their vision is for things like the credits, for things like the Dathomir fauna and such. I'm not sure how much they're really considering a lot of the stuff that we as fans might pick up on.
I was kind of disappointed not to see Rancors also, being that they are so established as a big part of Dathomir. But I just took that as, we know how difficult and expensive it is for new character models. And we got a ton of new character models in this trilogy, new environments, new ships. So that a Rancor may not have been in the budget. It would have been nice to see it. It would have been awesome. It would have confirmed a lot of things. But us not seeing one doesn't necessarily mean that they're not there. But I think Sidious may have picked Dooku with that thought in mind, that he's an ex-Jedi, he wants to get some of his former glory back, but he's not going to be the type that's going to try to rise to power and take me out. And he's just kind of the stand-in until Anakin comes of age. So really, was he always intended to be an apprentice? I'd say yes. That's what Sidious intended. I don't think Sidious would have ever thought that, hey, I have to watch my back from this guy, because I don't think he expected him to make the grab for power. Is he thinking somewhere down the line, Anakin's probably going to make the grab for power? Oh, yeah. Dooku, not so much.
I wonder if he just chose him, you know, I choose you as my apprentice because I don't need Peter Serafinowicz to come in and play your frickin' voice. You can play your own Darth Christopher Lee.
Or maybe he just thought he was so old that he would die before he got the chance to make the grab for power.
Geriatric power!
Hello, everyone. It's Arnie. I was just calling in with this voicemail because I saw something that I didn't realize. I'd seen the Savage Opress up in Chicago. What I didn't realize was Savage's voice was provided by Clancy Brown. Now, Clancy Brown is an actor who I think all of our listeners are going to be familiar with. He was the Kurgan in the original Highlander film. He was Victor in The Bride way back in the 80s. He was the sheriff in Pet Sematary 2. But where I think he's probably best known for to our listeners is he was Captain Hadley in Shawshank Redemption, which is probably playing on TNT right now. No matter when you're listening to this, it's probably playing on TNT right now. And where I first really got to know him was as Sergeant Zim in Starship Troopers. He was just great in that. And for me, he will forever be Brother Justin from the canceled too early HBO series Carnival. He's done a lot of voice work, it turns out. I didn't realize he's been pretty much the official voice of Lex Luthor for a little bit over a decade, and now he is Savage Opress. I think he did a great job, and now that I know it's him, I can kind of see it, but didn't realize, and thought the listeners might not either. So, Savage Opress, Sergeant Zim. Thanks, guys. Look forward to the show.
Thank you for those voicemails. Once again, we want to encourage everybody to call in and leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI. You too can be on the next episode of Republic Forces Radio Network. We do have one special announcement this week. Everyone who tweeted in for the chance to win the Savage Opress t-shirt, the winner is Dirty AT-AT. That's right. Dirty AT-AT, DirtyAT-AT. Now, Dirty AT-AT needs to send Star Wars Action News a private message on Twitter with his / her shipping info, and we will get the t-shirt right out to you. We did get a preview of next week's episode, Witches of the Mist. So what did we think? Look good? Look bad? Look like we've already seen it before?
I'm concerned for both Asajj and Savage's health at the end of this episode. A little bit. I don't want him to get killed because I want to see more of them.
I love the ending of the preview. I'm hoping the comedic timing is the same in the episode as it is in the preview, and there's not some big drawn out thing in the middle. The way we'll take him together, and then a split second later, you see them just completely slap down the hallway like they're nothing. It's a beautiful tie in to Attack of the Clones and funny as heck. I actually literally burst out laughing the first time that I saw that, and that hasn't happened a while with this show.
Nathan, you realize that not only will the comedic timing not even be there, those won't be connected scenes. They're going to be like thrown through that hallway by like an explosion or something.
They'll say, we'll take him together, and it's like they're going to escort somebody somewhere. My call or yours?
So this preview has me excited and scared at the same time. It looks great. Lots of lightsaber duels. Savage showing that he can hold his own against pretty much everybody. But on the other hand, they're completely, and I know we expected this to happen in this trilogy, that yes, Asajj is going to reveal herself as still alive and make her move on Dooku. But it's a little soon. I mean, the guy's just fresh out of the box, and he's had one whole fight, unless we're supposed to assume, or they're going to tell us that this takes place sometime after these first two episodes. It seems a little soon, and it worries me that he's going to They're going to put a saber through Savage in his first three episodes. So I'm a little nervous about that. I hope they don't do it, but we shall see.
I'm really hoping that, and I'm sort of hoping this, sort of not, because I like the dramatic potential for the series, but I'm hoping that somehow they're paving the way for Ventress to somehow prove herself. Like, see, I tried to take you down. I am worthy. I did survive, and make her follow Dooku again. I mean, as much as that feels like it'd be sort of a down note for these three episodes with all the potential that's there. If she doesn't somehow return to the fold for Dooku, there's a lot of EU that gets wiped out. There's her entire ending in the EU vanishes, unless they find some way to bring her back around to Dooku, because in the comics she never leaves. And of course she doesn't show up much in the novels, but in the comics she never does leave his employer, his tutelage. So you got to wonder, are they going to bring it around? Or are they really going in an independent spirit here, and they're really just going to drag out the Asajj Ventress thing, perhaps even having her never return to Dooku? It'd be a bold choice to do that, but I'm concerned continuity-wise for what they may do with it, for what we see in Obsession, which is only one of the only stories that we know for sure has to take place after this series so far.
Okay, here's my bold prediction in the same breath of Satine being behind all the corruption on Mandalore. Dooku and Asajj are in on this together to take out the Night Sisters, I don't know why, and to just make Sidious think that Asajj is out of the picture, but now they have Savage too. All right, actually, I don't even believe that, but I do think that this preview looked pretty cool, and I can't wait to see what the, you know, what the punchline really is to who's fighting who, because I actually thought it was really weird that Obi-Wan and Anakin are, like, at a table looking in the crystal ball with Mother Talzin, so I'm like, man, where is this going?
One thing I'm definitely looking forward to also, since we've seen preview clips of this one, we know that next week, the on-air premiere of Republic Commandos for the first time, maybe not for very long, but we finally get to see that scene that's been building up in the background as one of these many previews that show us too much. We'll finally get a chance to see the Republic Commandos enter the Clone Wars cartoon series proper, and that is a really cool look, even if they don't wind up perhaps being used as the same characterizations we've seen before, or as same characters as they use the character model more. I'm excited to see that form of clone trooper finally enter the Clone Wars cartoon.
And might I say that everything from the One Night Only events has been pretty positive, so I think we've got something good coming to us, not a disappointing ending, you know, like, oh, shoot, they just wasted this, wasted that. No, everybody was pretty excited about what they saw here based on what I've heard, not only from Star Wars Action News, but from other, you know, notable people from the fan community. But the I think there's a lot to be positive about and look forward to.
Nathan, I'm with you. I'm looking forward to seeing the Commandos, too. I've been hoping to see them in animated form since this series premiered, and that it looks like we're going to see Delta Squad first off is exciting. I'm a little concerned with the look of Sev, because it looks like they've gone with just kind of a red streaky look rather than the bloody handprint look that he had before. That's kind of disappointing. But all in all, I'm looking forward to seeing some Commandos, so it should be cool.
Going back to what Jerry said, I'm excited to see what they're going to do with Mother Talzin, too, because she seems like she seems almost insincere with a lot of the stuff she says, and I'm wondering what side of the fence she's playing, and if it's anybody's agenda but her own, so I'm kind of looking forward to the resolution of that, too.
With this being Delta Squad, by the way, you got to wonder how this plays into, you know, Karen Travis eventually saying there was stuff that was being done in the Clone Wars that wouldn't allow her to continue doing the series, or at least the way that she wanted to, but also, you may remember that the fate of Sev, I believe it was left pretty much out of bounds. She wasn't allowed to play with what happens to him afterwards. So you gotta wonder, are they maybe trying to take some of those characters that were initially developed for the video game that got spun off into the novels, and maybe they're going to use them in a more elaborate way than just the little scene that we get that just is a quick preview? It'll be interesting. I doubt there'll be much we'll learn next week as to why the Republic Commandos being here caused all the Karen Travis stuff or had some impact on the Karen Travis stuff, but it makes for some fun speculation.
Now I'm going to play Barrent in this case. If we're going to see Republic Commandos, then hopefully we're going to see Republic Commando figures, which those would be cool in the animated style. And then turning right back around, since, as Rose said, they're going to do some of the Clone Wars characters in realistic styles, it'd be nice to see them do a reissue of Delta Squad with some nice articulation and some good sculpting. So,
speaking of realistic styles for Clone Wars characters, if you didn't get a chance to pick up the 99-cent indoor downloadable content for The Force Unleashed 2, or I guess not the indoor one, the character pack that was with the indoor one that was released at the same time also for 99 cents, there's an awesome Obi-Wan Kenobi skin that's Obi-Wan as he, basically as he appears in his kind of quasi-clone trooper style armor in the Clone Wars era. With the helmet off, but it's done in a realistic style, not an animated style. It's one of the coolest skins for that game.
Yes, I did pick that up. And in honor of the Ginger Prince, I have played through as Admiral Ackbar. All right. Well, good discussion. Want to thank everybody for joining us, and also want to thank Jen, Jerry, and Nathan, and look forward to getting back together next week to talk about Witches of the Mist.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Berent, and Nathan P. Butler of StarWarsFanWorks.com. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars and all that the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademark, Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a production of Venganza Media Incorporated, copyright 2011, all rights reserved.
I'm now, Dan, now that we have hijacked your show completely, what were your thoughts on the episode?
Now that we've talked about the whole show, I was just going to say, wow, it was an action-packed weekend in the Nathan P. Butler household with you sitting around counting how many times people talked.
Hey, that was this afternoon, my friend. That was one boring. I will say I got through an entire bag of barbecue chips and probably two Dr. Peppers in the process. It's sort of my equivalent of drinking your way through something.
We want to take this time to thank everybody who tweeted in their response for the opportunity to win the Savage. Yeah, I did it.
It's the Macho Man Savage Oppressed.
All right. Yeah.
Stop it.
Snap it to my brother's neck.
There's your outtake.
Good night, John Boy.
I've done voices for fan audio dramas based on the Kurgan, the way that Clancy Brown does it. I mean, it is an awesome voice. He's one of my favorite voice actors. And he's done Star Wars before. He's done Montross and Bounty Hunter. We'll touch on that in Continuity Corner. He really is just this presence. And the funny thing is he almost always plays these villains, like Lex Luthor. But everything I've ever read about him as an individual puts him as one of the nicest guys you could ever run into, which is I guess, a credit to the voice acting.
Well, he is Mr. Krabs, too. I mean, come on. There's got to be a lighter side to him.
This is true.
Is he really Mr. Krabs?
Yes, he is.
I know, really?
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Hey, Dooku, me boy!
I did not know that. That's hilarious. I want to see the outtakes where he records just like a scene.
Taking all my lightsabers!